This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Richtig spannend, richtig vielfältig. Das ist deine Karriere bei Kaufland. Ob Trainee-Programm, Direkteinstieg, Studentenjob oder Praktikum. Finde bei uns den Einstieg, der zu dir passt. Profitiere von einer attraktiven Vergütung, spannenden Aufgaben und individuellen Entwicklungsmöglichkeiten. Werde jetzt Teil unseres Teams. Bewirb dich jetzt unter kaufland.de/studenten. Kaufland, hier bin ich richtig.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 29th of January. As the centre-right CDU party in Germany passes a tough border motion in Parliament with the help of the AfD, the far-right party that's surging in the opinion polls, we'll ask what it means for next month's German general election and whether the so-called firewall in that country that prevents the populist right from wielding power is crumbling. Also, do the government's plans for airport expansion pass the green smell test? We'll hear about the mood of depression among the opposition in Belarus, the sense of control in the Trump White House, and we find out what's behind Bridget Jones's enduring appeal as the fourth film in the franchise hits the screens. Is this the sound of a German political firewall beginning to crumble? Well, that is what the voices behind that hubbub of heckling think. The firewall in question is the one that prevents Germany's traditional political parties from working with the far right. But today in the German parliament, the Bundestag, a motion on immigration policy was narrowly passed, which heralded for some a worrying taboo-breaking moment in German history. The motion is not binding. It was proposed by the front-runner to become the next German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, of the conservative CDU, and it includes a plan to stop asylum seekers at Germany's borders. Now, it only passed with the support of the AfD, the party from the populist right that has gained traction and gained the vocal support of Elon Musk, but which until now has been off-limits as a coalition partner for the traditional centrist parties. But with a general election approaching next month and a recent series of attacks where the main suspect has been an asylum seeker, the CDU's leader proposed an AfD-friendly motion, much to the anger of his socialist opponent, the current Chancellor Olaf Scholz.
They accept the support of the AfD for their unlawful proposals. You are supporting those who fight our democracy, who despise our united Europe, who have been poisoning the climate in our country for years. That is a grave mistake, an unforgivable mistake.
Well, for the AfD, it is a mistake to have a firewall against what they consider simply to be democracy. And after the vote, they claimed they had led the CDU across the Rubicon. Bernd Baumann is an MP from the AfD.
A new era is beginning here and now. Something new is starting and we are leading it. The new forces are leading it. These are the forces of the AfD. You can follow Mr. Merz if you still have the strength.
Well, we can cross now to our correspondent in Berlin, Jessica Parker. Jess, first of all, can you give us the background to this motion that was passed today?
Yeah, of course. Good evening. As you mentioned, there's been a series of attacks in Germany over the last year involving suspects who've got an asylum background. And that has taken what was already a pretty tense debate about immigration to an even more fraught place. And Friedrich Merz, who, as you mentioned, he's the front runner to become the next chancellor, his party's polling top. He came out with this plan to basically table a bunch of stricter immigration rules. So tonight he tabled this non-binding motion, and then on Friday he's actually going to bring forward legislation. But the motion tonight, as you mentioned, relied on support from Alternative for Deutschland. And it's the fact that it passed with help from the far right that is causing such a stink in German politics.
Yes, I mean, the atmosphere sounded pretty fraught in the Bundestag.
Yeah, I mean, German politics is not like British politics. People here, in Germany sometimes watch PMQs. They find it fascinating because it's so rowdy. But in the Bundestag, this was a pretty heated session. There was recriminations, there was heckling, partly because some lawmakers really hated the policies that Friedrich Merz is suggesting. But a lot of the anger was about the fact that Merz was signalling and had signalled that he would go along with AfD support, even if he is saying that he's not comfortable with having their support, that actually he'd rather work with the other parties. But he argues that these measures are necessary and he is responding to voters' concerns. But it's interesting as well, I think, because he said he won't go into coalition with Alternative for Deutschland. There's a possibility what he's done now might damage trust with actual potential coalition partners. But for the AfD, you heard them celebrating, they hate the firewall. They think it's undemocratic. And tonight, they definitely think they've done some damage to it.
Jess, many thanks. Jessica Parker there in Berlin. Well, immediately after that vote, I spoke to a senior MP from the centre-right CDU, Jürgen Hart. I asked him what message his party was trying to send by proposing this motion.
If you don't act as government, you have not to wonder that radicals from left and right might rise and the democratic majority might shrink. And therefore we say if we have not a concrete answer to those people who ask for more action of the state concerning the refugees, then you have to aware that they vote for other non-democratic parties, and therefore we put this motion. We will have another motion on Friday, a decision on Friday in the Bundestag on a proposal of a new law of us, and we will see who is supporting us or not.
Well, at the moment, you know that the AfD is supporting this, don't you? And that is what is causing a lot of concern, because there has been the tradition within German politics that the parties from the traditional centre, yours, the Socialists, the Greens, the Free Democrats, have not teamed up, and that's the word that Chancellor Scholz has used for what is happening, teamed up with the AfD, the populists on the right or indeed the left. Do you not believe that this is crossing some kind of political Rubicon?
The crossing of the lines is because of the fact that the government has not a majority in the Deutsche Bundestag. At the moment, we have the situation that there's no majority behind Olaf Scholz, no majority behind the red and green groups in the Deutsche Bundestag. The political power of AfD would be bigger if we don't do our political work, presenting our concepts. After the new election in Germany, after the 23rd of February and to the building of a coalition, there will be a strong coalition of democratic powers in Germany, rejecting all proposals coming from the opposition.
So just let me just be absolutely clear on this. Are you saying that despite the support of the AfD on this motion, the CDU still categorically rules out going into coalition with them after the election?
We gave the guarantee, and be sure, we will not do a coalition with the Trojanic horse of Russia and Germany, which is AfD, not with a political party that wants to leave European Union and joining the economic community of Putin, and also probably leaving the NATO. We have no common ground with AfD in political points. That there are some points
just to break in, if I may, they do feel they have common ground with you on this motion that has passed, don't they?
They have probably common ground on some topics and some points that we also see necessary in the question of immigration policy. Unfortunately, we are in a situation that we have huge challenges in Germany, also coming from our constituencies, from the people on the street, that we have to do something against the knife attacks and against people that are going around in Germany and needed to be arrested or sent back to the country from. My voters would question mark me and my engagement for them if I don't agree and don't vote in favor of motions of my group that I supported and decided to bring in on the table, only due to the fact that probably the wrong might vote on it. The law that we will agree on Friday this week, this was put on the table of the Deutsche Bundestag in September last year as an action, a reaction on the brutal, bloody attack with 3 people died and 8 people wounded in my constituency, on the birthday celebration of my city, where I am the member of the Deutsche Bundestag. I could never explain to my voters in Solingen not to vote in favor of that law we put into the Deutsche Bundestag in September, and that was rejected by the old coalition majority in November, only due to the fact that now liberals and also AfD, as it was in September, by the way, vote in favor of that.
That was Jürgen Hart, an MP from the centre-right CDU. So, just how unprecedented are today's events? To discuss that, I'm joined by the German historian and journalist Katja Hoyer. Good evening, Katja.
Hello.
This firewall that is said to exist to block those on the extremes from entering into German government, did it take a hit today, do you think?
Well, it certainly wasn't broken, I think. I mean, as we've just heard, there's no intention from the Conservatives to actually form a sort of formal coalition with the AfD. But on this instance, they do have common ground with them. And as Friedrich Merz is the leader of the Conservatives, as he's sort of said, you know, the idea that they can't bring forward a law that they want to bring forward because the wrong people might agree with it, has now led to a point where they basically saw no other way, you know, other than doing that, because it would be absurd not to.
And of course, the AfD is arguing that, look, they are where the German people are on this. And I guess the fact that the CDU have done this is a tacit sign of agreement.
Yeah, I mean, most of the surveys that came out throughout last year, especially in the wake of these sort of, you know, attacks that we've just heard about, show that about two-thirds or so of the German public want much stricter rules on so-called irregular migration to Germany. And the problem with that has always been that the majority of the political parties in Germany are sort of left-leaning and would never, you know, there wouldn't be a majority for politics that basically the majority of the population want. So it now fell to basically the opposition. The Conservatives are currently in opposition to put a motion forward after another brutal attack in Bavaria. And that's why we're in this kind of weird situation now where they rely on the far right to agree with that.
Could this have any impact on the election? Could we see, as for example, we've seen in places like the Netherlands, parties in the centre-right essentially going onto the ground that has traditionally been to that occupied by more populist parties and finding actually they end up looking like a weaker version of them and voters perhaps turning away from them?
Well, I think the problem that they have seen is that the AfD has grown so fast. So we're talking at the moment, you know, a doubling of the votes from last time, from 2021. And even in the last few weeks, they've risen sort of 2-3 points in the polls and are now well over a fifth of the vote. So I think what the idea behind this is that basically the Conservatives know that a lot of Conservative disgruntled voters have gone over to the AfD rather than the other way around. And they do need to go, you know, as the MP has just explained for his constituency in Solingen, and they can't turn around to their own voters and say, we're not doing what you're asking us to do.
Briefly, can the CDU line hold then? If the AfD does very well in the election, can that line that they simply won't go into coalition with them hold?
I think it can. I mean, the nuclear option, if they can't find a way back to a coalition with the centre-left parties, the nuclear option would be a minority government, in which case they would rely on votes from the AfD, but they wouldn't form a coalition with them. So that would definitely be a weakening of the firewall, but not a complete tearing down of it.
So what kind of moment is this, do you think, in broader German political history?
Well, I think what's happening here isn't dissimilar to what we've seen in the US and also in other European countries, in the sense that the population has for a long time, I think, been more conservative and maybe even more right-wing than leaders have. And that's beginning, because we live in democracies, basically, that's beginning to seep through, I think, into the political leadership. And I think Germany has been more reluctant to go that way than other countries. So what we've seen in, say, Austria or the Netherlands or the US is delayed in Germany because there's a reluctance to go further right because of Germany's Nazi past. But now I think this has reached a point with all of these attacks and also a rising amount of criminality on the streets that is really there in the statistics, you know, where politicians are responding to this because they're worried that if people in their frustration go further right, if they don't respond to it. So this is really a significant shift, I think.
Katja, many, many thanks. German historian and journalist Katja Heuer there.
Richtig spannend, richtig vielfältig. Das ist deine Karriere bei Kaufland. Ob Trainee-Programm, Direkteinstieg, Studentenjob oder Praktikum. Finde bei uns den Einstieg, der zu dir passt. Profitiere von einer attraktiven Vergütung, spannenden Aufgaben und individuellen Entwicklungsmöglichkeiten. Werde jetzt Teil unseres Teams. Bewirb dich jetzt unter kaufland.de/studenten. Kaufland, hier bin ich richtig.
Now, few people are arguing with the need for economic growth in this country, the ambition, of course, that underpins the Chancellor's proposals announced today for a third runway at Heathrow Airport and expansions at Luton and Gatwick and a plan to bring Doncaster Airport back into use. Where the debate does come, though, is over the impact those plans will have on growth, but also on the government's ability to meet its net zero obligations. Now, the details of all of this is still being worked out, but the government says it will put out an airport national policy statement in the next few months that will ensure the third runway at Heathrow is, quote, in line with legal, environmental and climate obligations. To achieve that, Rachel Reeves is counting on new ways to make air travel greener with sustainable fuels offsetting the extra emissions. But climate campaigners are pretty sceptical. Let's discuss this now with the Labour MP Toby Perkins, who's chair of the Environmental Audit Committee. Good evening.
Hi, good evening.
So look, the reliance, for example, on sustainable jet fuel for this by the government, its target for use this year is 2% of the total. Can it really be scaled up in time to help the government meet those obligations?
I mean, I think it's a very valid question. I think there's a number of very valid questions coming out of this. The government have repeated their commitment today that unless this meets the environmental commitments that the country has, it won't go ahead. But clearly the announcements today sounded very much like the government believed that was achievable. So, I mean, it will be the role for the Environmental Audit Committee to make sure that as we get the sixth carbon budgets, which now include aircraft aviation emissions, that we scrutinise very carefully the credibility of those plans.
Yeah, because at the moment, the plans for net zero relies on the rollout of these fuels, which is itself up for question, but also on no further expansion in UK airport capacity. One's going up, the other might not be going up to meet it. That is a pretty big question mark, isn't it?
Yeah, a very big question mark. I mean, I absolutely welcome the drive for growth. As you rightly say, we all know that we need to get the growth in the economy. There's long-term decisions that have been put off for year after year, and that's why we have crumbling infrastructure in this country. So I really welcome the fact the government sees that today in a very positive speech. But there are very big questions that remain. And, you know, it is welcome that we have that commitment that without the environmental commitments being met, this won't go ahead. But there is a huge body of work from where we are now to the production of credible plans that has not yet been satisfied.
And how then do you intend to hold the government to account on its commitments?
Well, so the Climate Change Committee will be producing the sixth carbon budgets in February. The seventh carbon budgets in February, and we'll be scrutinising those. The sixth carbon budgets that the previous government had put in place that were quite ambitious, but actually lack quite a lot of detail, still need to be scrutinised and will include these proposals. So there's going to be a substantial amount of work looking at how the government gets to the point of making the sixth carbon budgets credible, and then, you know, how it moves on further from that. We saw the Prime Minister committing the UK to ambitious emission targets at COP29, but the detail of how those are going to be achieved, it still hasn't been presented.
Right, and do you think the work hasn't been done yet, given that these announcements today have already come out?
Well, I mean, it's important to be clear about what those announcements are. You know, there was clearly positive noise about Heathrow, but those environmental safeguards were still, you know, expressly said the law hasn't changed.
Yeah, I'm just interested. Was this more about the noise then than about the actual practicalities? Was this just an attempt to try and improve confidence, get investors and businesses more confident where the economy is going, rather than actually a realistic plan for expansion?
I think it's unfair to say that at this stage. I think it is a government that's really committed to growth, but in terms of the environmental commitments, that they have not yet been demonstrated. So I think we should take the government seriously on what they're saying, but the carbon budgets that still need to be revealed, there is a lot of work to do from where we are now. And I think the government did inherit carbon budgets that hadn't been fully worked out, and over this next few months, there's a substantial body of work to do. But I think it's also important to say that not making these decisions, that there are those who would just like to see the government scrap all their environmental commitments. There's those that say any kind of growth, that the UK should be a sort of even more of an outlier than we are in terms of our ambition compared to Europe and America and even more so China. And I think the government are trying to tread that middle path of being very ambitious on the environment, but also delivering that growth. And so I think we should give them the credit for that, but also, absolutely express that we're going to hold their feet to the fire.
Toby Perkins, Labour MP, Chair of the Environmental Audit Committee. Thanks very much. Now, Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus has claimed another victory after he was awarded 87% of the vote in Sunday's presidential election. But it was an election in name only, with all genuine opposition either in prison or forced to flee abroad, following the mass detentions of protesters after the previous widely disputed election in 2020. When the BBC's Russia editor Steve Rosenberg asked Mr. Lukashenko about releasing those political prisoners during a freewheeling news conference on Sunday, he received the tart reply, "Don't overdo it, Steve." Well, exiles are warning that the Belarus leader, a close ally of Vladimir Putin's, poses a danger far beyond his country's borders. Although these days the opposition's mood seems rather more depressed than defiant, as our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports from Warsaw.
In 2020, this was the sound of defiance in Belarus. The Free Choir sang on the streets as crowds flooded out, protesting against an election rigged to keep Alexander Lukashenko in power. The choir are now in exile. But even here in Poland, they perform with red and white masks covering their faces, because the security forces back home have warned that anyone supporting the opposition, even abroad, can be prosecuted. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya doesn't hide her face. She had to flee Belarus too in 2020, after running for president against Lukashenko and claiming a win. Then came the protests, the police brutality, and the mass arrests. This election was very different.
No independent candidates, no observers, no free media, all real opponents either in prison or in exile, so it's sham.
Do you still feel now that there is a chance of democratic change? Yes. How confident do you feel that that moment will actually come?
I truly believe it was a huge shift in mentality of Belarusians. How long it will take, I don't know, but it's very important that this shift that took place in 2020, it will not disappear.
But it's hard to keep that conviction alive. That's what this entire event in Warsaw was about. Because 4 years after they tried and failed to topple a dictator, the Belarusians I've been speaking to are struggling. Yana is a vet, just out of prison after serving 3 years for joining the peaceful protests. She calculates that 1 in 10 of the inmates in her prison were there for their politics.
It was only when I could sleep again that I realized how emotionally and physically hard it had been, how I had suppressed my feelings. I barely cried in prison, but when I got out, I suddenly found I wanted to sob all the time. I thought I'd got through it okay, but I realized it had taken titanic force.
Poland is now home to huge numbers of Belarusians, driven out not by war, but by fear of interrogation, intimidation, and arrest. Some opposition supporters have stayed in Belarus, like Maria, although that's not her real name. But she tells me all open activism in the country has stopped. It's just too dangerous. She used to attend court hearings for political detainees, but even that's too risky now. She could be prosecuted herself as an extremist. It is horribly frustrating, Maria says, to see the injustice and to feel so helpless. And as those forced into exile sang of a different future, back in Minsk, Alexander Lukashenko was claiming 87% support for another term as president. It's his seventh so far.
So far, that was Sarah Rainsford reporting from Warsaw. A day after Cardiff University outlined a cost-cutting proposal involving the loss of 400 full-time jobs and a number of courses, there has been reaction from beyond the world of higher education. Nursing is one of the courses that could face the axe at the end of a three-month consultation period. Helen Wiley is the executive director of the Royal College of Nursing Wales, and she told BBC Radio Wales Breakfast the proposals are worrying.
Whilst we accept it's a proposal at the current time, it threatens the supply of nursing into some of our largest health boards in South Wales. And at a time when we have a significant number of nursing vacancies, it doesn't take a mathematician to work out that the students that come through Cardiff University are a very important contribution into that pipeline.
Well, Professor Wendy Lana is the Vice-Chancellor of Cardiff University. I asked her about those concerns that the university's proposals could threaten Wales's supply of nurses.
We absolutely understand that the pipeline of nurses in Wales is crucial. We absolutely understand the pressures that the NHS is under. The question we want to ask and the conversation we want to have with our external stakeholders is, are we the best provider for nursing, or are there other ways in which nursing might be delivered in South East Wales that is actually much more satisfactory? The model of HE is changing at the moment. We will need to prioritise more for the future.
Well, what are the funding pressures that have led you to reach this point when you are announcing the possible closure of 400 posts and the axing of several courses?
Home undergraduate fees have not kept pace with the cost of delivering that education. Our research does not pay for itself. Universities in many Anglophone environments have been using international student revenue as a way to ensure that the universities are financially viable. The cost pressures are extraordinary on us. Inflation has affected universities. It's a perfect storm. It's a house of cards, and the house of cards is crumbling.
When it comes to foreign students and the reliance on them, was this not something that universities might have foreseen?
International students are a great thing. That's not the challenge. The challenge is the business model that universities have been operating under for the last while, in which the fees that those students pay have become more and more crucial to universities remaining financially viable. And as the international students have stopped coming in the numbers that they have, that's when the challenge has really ramped up. We did know this was coming. But even people like me who have been saying for a while, you know what, the current pattern of global mobility is not going to persist, could not have seen the cliff that those numbers are now falling off.
So you would push back then at an accusation, just to use your metaphor, that you, not just you personally, but a lot of leading people in leading universities are the ones who have built the House of Cards.
Well, I mean, like any sector, we had operating models, we had business models that were fit for purpose for the time that they were in. Times have changed, those aren't holding. We're not the first sector that's had to reinvent ourselves.
So what are you calling for to try and, I assume you would like, to stave off the cuts that you are proposing?
So there is talk about some sort of review of university funding models. There are already initiatives in the sector that I thoroughly support, efforts to enhance transnational education. If international students aren't going to come to us in the same numbers, we should be going to them.
But in the short term, the clock is ticking now. This is a 3-month consultation process you've announced. And if nothing changes, these posts, these courses will disappear from Cardiff.
You're absolutely right. These new revenue streams that universities around the world are beginning to explore will not come on stream quickly. That makes it even more important that we address concerns of academic and financial sustainability. We are part of just a chain of announcements that, you know, every day, every week, it feels another university makes really hard decisions.
That was Professor Wendy Lana, Vice-Chancellor of Cardiff University. 9 days into Donald Trump's second term in office, and it's already pretty clear that anyone who follows it closely is risking a case of journalistic whiplash as the returning US president continues to make news in many directions, often at the same time. Today, he signed his first law since returning to the White House. He proposed that the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center should house thousands of undocumented migrants. He also appeared to do a U-turn on a plan to pause all federal spending. Well, joining us now, Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent for The New York Times, covering his sixth presidency. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Are you feeling a case of whiplash? Can you hear me, Peter?
I hear you, yeah.
Yes, I can. No, I sort of said, look, you know, there's so much going on with the second Trump presidency. Yes. It feels like a case of whiplash sometimes. How does it feel like to you?
Oh, whiplash, I think, would be actually better than it feels. I mean, it's hard to keep up. You're right. This is a deliberate strategy by the new president, a flood-the-zone strategy where he's just firing off changes and orders and actions with extraordinary velocity, partly in order to overwhelm any opposition and to overwhelm the media in some way so that there's not able to be as much coverage on any individual decision that might provoke controversy or opposition. And, you know, so far he's managed to have quite a lot of impact in a very short amount of time.
But what of this U-turn? Democrats are saying, look, this is his first defeat in office. Just tell us a bit, what have you heard about this decision and what's come out today?
Right, exactly. Well, it's obviously a bungle on their part. They put out an order on Monday night saying they're going to freeze as much as $3 trillion worth of federal grants and loans, which are used by a lot of organizations, states and localities and non-governmental organizations and so forth to provide services for Americans across the board. And they couldn't really even explain exactly what they were doing. They were trying to do what they said temporarily to scour this money and these grants and make sure that it didn't contradict his priorities on things like diversity and climate and so forth, but they couldn't explain who was getting cut and for how long and how it worked. They said it wouldn't be Social Security or Medicare, but they couldn't tell us whether it would be, for instance, Medicaid. And so within hours, a judge stepped in and said, no, this isn't legal. You're not allowed to change what Congress has decided you're supposed to spend. And by today, they retreated back down and withdrew the memo.
What sort of early conclusions are you drawing from how this White House is operating? I mean, all the talk in the run-up to the inauguration was, look, this is a team much more at one with the Trump project, more disciplined. They won't have the people that he had around him in the first term who were speaking truth to power, if you like. But how are they operating?
Yeah, all that you said is true. I think exactly right. They've had 4 years out of office to think about what they wanted to do in these early days. And unlike 8 years ago, when he first came into office with no experience in politics or government at all, really, he has now experience and has figured out how he wants to do things. And one of the things he figured out is not to surround himself with establishment Republicans or other people he doesn't believe are really on board. So the people around him now, you're right, they're much more fervent in their belief in the cause, and they're much more willing to use aggressive methods than the people he had around him 8 years ago.
I mean, retribution is a word that sort of keeps coming up. He used it on the campaign trail, but I guess also intolerance for anyone who is not loyal, who is not on what they call the Trump train. Is that how it feels?
Loyalty is number one for Trump, absolutely. And he's already begun to purge the government of people he suspects of being disloyal to him. Everybody from prosecutors, career prosecutors who were involved in the investigations of his various, indictments, but also people like, federal civil servants who are just simply not seen as part of the loyalty train, to use your phrase. And it's, you know, in some cases, there's going to be legal challenges. There's only so much a president can do in terms of he could replace political appointees, but civil servants are supposed to have protection. They're supposed to be nonpartisan. He's trying to make them loyalists to him.
Well, strap yourself in, Peter, in for quite a ride over the next 4 years. Peter Baker, a chief White House correspondent for The New York Times there. Now, almost a quarter of a century after she first appeared on our screens, Bridget Jones is back, this time with two children and no Mark Darcy. Bridget Jones, Mad About the Boy, premiered in London this evening. It's the fourth installment in the franchise, created, of course, by Helen Fielding. Bridget's now a 51-year-old widow and a single parent who's grappling with texts, tweets, dating apps and Botox.
Did you have sex last night?
Yes. I did. I had a full night of utterly mind-blowing sex, and it was amazing.
Sounds like she's having fun. How has she, the character, endured, though? Film critic Siobhan Sinnott joins me now. Good evening, Siobhan.
Good evening.
Now, this franchise has spanned the ages, literally, hasn't it? Yeah. I mean, she's grown old with her audience. Is that why it's so appealing?
Well, it's appealing to the film industry because the first movie, when it came out in 2001, grossed £222 million. And even the last one, in Bridget Jones's Baby in 2016, also broke UK box office records with an opening weekend of about £8 million, which is the largest sum for any September opening, a record for any romantic comedy, which is one reason why Bridget Jones is back. But yes, I think already Bridget Jones is a phenomena. We rarely see rom-com heroines after they've had their happy ending, much less see them age across the decades. I can't think of another heroine who's been given a film arc as long as Bridget, apart from something like Sigourney Weaver in the Alien films. And even then, she's not the same character, let alone a zeitgeist figure like Bridget, who began in the books finding her path between success and failure, work and weight watching, trying to choose between a bad boy boss who sends her suggestive emails and that decent but stuffy human rights lawyer, Mark Darcy. And all the time, she's brutally self-critical.
And what is it that gives her an appeal? And this is what the author Helen Fielding says, to a new audience, a Gen Z audience.
Yeah, I think the ability of Bridget to move with the times. If you look back at the first Bridget Jones now, there's a lot of stuff there you couldn't get away with today. You know, Hugh Grant's as Daniel Cleaver in The Age of Me Too. Save those leering emails for the Industrial Tribunal, Bridget Jones. Cigarettes are no longer raffish and reckless, and all those weight worries might be frowned on as being less than body positive. So there's things that a modern generation of singletons, you know, might not relate to. Nobody drinks quite like Bridget, perhaps. But she's still a barometer for how we talk about women and the concerns about women. As you say, she's now in her 50s. She's widowed. She's got two kids. She's dealing with a relationship with a 20-year-old man. But, you know, Bridget remains on the cutting edge because that younger man is Leo Woodall, who's actually born in the same year that the first book was published, and is currently the hot Brit bloke of the moment, thanks to his starring roles in One Day and White Lotus. So, and let's not forget that Helen Fielding based Mark Darcy, human rights lawyer, on Sir Keir Starmer.
Interesting. Very, very, very zeitgeisty indeed. Siobhan, many thanks for joining us. Film critic Siobhan Sinnott there on the enduring appeal of Bridget Jones. Our closing headlines tonight. Germany's parliament descended into heckles and recriminations this afternoon after what's been called a firewall against working with the far right cracked. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says that she wants the planning application for a third runway at Heathrow Airport in London to be signed off by the next election. She confirmed in a speech today that the government would back the project alongside a series of other infrastructure schemes. But there has been scepticism from Green campaigners, and there is opposition from figures including the Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan. That is The World Tonight. I'm James Kamara-Sami. For now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.